Hello, my name is Abigail Stewart, and my favorite thing is artists' journals.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones. It is Sunday, March 19th, and we're back. I was at the beginning of the month. I had COVID. I had made it 3 full years without getting COVID. Somehow I got through all of my chemotherapy and breast cancer treatment without getting COVID. And I, you know, I think like a lot of people, my masking is lax. And I think my booster, my bivalent booster that I got in August last year is waning. And I caught COVID. I was able to, the second day of symptoms, I tested myself, tested positive, had a telehealth appointment immediately, thank goodness, was able to get Paxlovid within a few hours of testing positive. And the Paxlovid kept the COVID a minor case. I'm still trying to understand how it has interplayed with the sarcoidosis, which was the chronic illness I was diagnosed with during some of my side adventures in breast cancer treatment, because I have certainly been weaker since I had COVID, and some of the joint pain that I had that had been relieved by new medicines is back. So I still highly recommend wearing a mask, getting your boosters, washing your hands, all that good stuff. Facebook yesterday reminded me that I'm exactly 1 year out from finishing radiation. That was on March 18th last year. Or no, today is, yeah, March 18th. So the day after St. Patrick's Day, which is significant because St. Patrick's Day is when I did my bat mitzvah when I turned 30. So I should be able to lock that date in as a happy date to celebrate. Ronnie and I did a classic steroid Saturday, which is something we did all through my chemotherapy treatments, which is a matinee movie when you know nobody's going to be in the theater. So you can have essentially a private showing and then a meal at an off hour to try and eliminate some risk. So we saw Cocaine Bear, and it is, go see it in a theater with people. I'm looking forward to seeing it a second time because I know there are visual jokes I missed because I was laughing so hard, or reacting to the surprising amount of gore, but funny gore and gore that moves the movie forward. What a fun. Elizabeth Banks really did a great job with this movie. But yeah, I'm a whole year out from radiation. You know, at this point, I think I'm like 6 months out from finishing my last infusion. My port scar is healed nicely, and all of my blood work has been good in the last few months. Nothing is elevated. I've had 2 mammograms since I finished radiation, and while I've got fat necrosis from my oncoplasty from my breast reduction, things continue to be clear from a breast cancer point of view. I'm just trying to get healthy again, or maybe not healthy, but get stronger, be more comfortable moving in the world. It is, you know, you finish treatment and it's not, you're not back to normal the next day. And I lamented to some coworkers recently, I had to park in a different parking garage at work, one that involves having to climb 2 flights of stairs that are just like 2 flights of stairs without a landing in the middle and without an elevator alternative. And I was like, man, my hair has grown back enough now that people can't look at me. People don't look at me and know I was a cancer patient. So they don't know these stairs are hard because I'm still recovering from chemo, and I'm still recovering from that treatment. But it is weird to be healed enough that there are people who know me now who never knew me when I was using a cane even, and I only stopped using a cane like 6 months ago. But they also didn't know me when I pre-pandemic, when I would do, you know, be out in the world 5 nights a week, bopping around and doing things. So I don't know. There's a lot to reflect on. A year out, I start thinking a little bit more about what is the art that I want to make about having gone through breast cancer, you know, and if the world needs another breast cancer story, who knows? But I sort of imagine what a graphic memoir might look like from time to time. But, you know, for now, finding favorites, I think, is the art that I made about enduring treatment. And it's one I'm still happy to continue making. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. I've got author Abigail Stewart. Her new book is available now. She published 3 books over the course of COVID. We talk about that. And then we talk about artist journals and all of the amazing things that artists have written that are available to us. So with all that said, wear a mask, wash your hands, get your bivalent boosters, and keep enjoying your favorite things. Hello and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we learn about people's favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. I took a week off because COVID said you're taking a week off, but I'm so happy to be back in the podcast saddle. And today I have Abby Stewart. She has a new book out, her third publication during COVID. A novel called Foundations. It's available on Bookshop and through her publisher. Foundations is a steely-eyed feminist multi-generational novel. Foundations is told in 3 parts following the lives of 3 women, all living in the same Dallas house in different eras, whose experiences parallel the history of women's rights struggles in the American South. Abby, how are you doing this evening?
I'm pretty good. You know, it's St. Patrick's Day. It's nice outside. And I actually just got over COVID too. So I'm feeling good to be testing negative.
Oh, good. Was it a post-AWP?
It wasn't. No, I actually got it right before. So it was like 2 weeks before AWP, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I made it 3 years.
There you go.
And then I woke up a few weeks ago. I woke up in the middle of the night and I was like, oh no, it's come for me.
Yeah, you know, you're like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm being visited by the ghosts of COVID. Yeah. So I feel for you. Glad you're feeling better though.
Yes. I do have, I will try to edit the ASMR out, but I do have a pile of cough drops next to my computer.
Ooh.
and a big water and a big lemonade and an inhaler. So
I love that. I mean, it's so many accoutrements for the COVID era.
Yeah. So Abby, I saw on your, I think I saw a tweet from you that was like, what the question, you had quote tweeted something that was, what are things that have happened to you since the lockdown started? And you've published 3 books over the course of COVID.
Yeah. So the first one, The Drowned Woman, was also published by Whiskey Tit, who put out Foundations as well. And they accepted it before COVID, but everything got pushed way back because of like there was no paper and then, you know, the presses were closed and things like that. So they ended up all being released kind of like one after the other very quickly, which wasn't the like original plan. But, you know, things happen. You roll with it. So, it came out like basically a year ago. And then in between, a micro press called Alien Buddha Press put out a collection of my short stories. And then Foundations came out a year after The Drowned Woman. So yeah, it's been a wild ride.
Wow. So I'm curious. So Supply Chain meant your first book came out later during COVID.
Yes.
How much of Foundations was written or edited during that maybe in during the lockdown. Was any of that book created during the lockdown, or is it just the timing that they've all hit now?
No. So Foundations was entirely written, edited, and accepted and published kind of during the COVID era. So yeah, it was, I wrote it like in 2020, I think, around that time when I kind of was, you know, the Drowned Woman publication was stalled. I knew that I wasn't going to be putting anything out like, you know, book release wise anytime soon. So I was like, I'm just going to work on a new project and get my mind off of it. And that is what became Foundations. So.
Amazing. I'm curious about where did the triple timeline, the idea of the triple timeline in one house come? How did that come to you?
That's such a good question. I was thinking kind of about homes and what we define as our home and really like the seen and unseen aspects of what is home. And if you think about it, you know, as a sense of place, as most people do, you know, these houses that we all kind of pass through, we leave something behind, whether it's like a feeling or an essence or, you know, something imbued in the walls that's left of us whenever we leave these houses. And I've lived in the same apartment for 7 years now. But, you know, these apartments were built in the 70s. So who knows who lived here before me? Mm-hmm. And I just love thinking about that idea that there's some kind of like surreal, I guess, maybe connection to who lived there before you and what the house meant to them, so that you could maybe, all of the women in the book are kind of following this path to find themselves, and they're kind of getting like a leg up or assist from the women that came before. Mm-hmm. And so I think that just building on the concept or the idea that there was someone here before me and like, what did they kind of incidentally leave behind? I don't know. That's kind of where I came up with it. And I thought that if we stacked those on top of each other, you know, what kind of story would it be?
Yeah. And you said it in your home state of Texas?
I did. So I have not written a lot of things that take place in Texas, just not for any real reason, just because I hadn't done it yet, really. And a lot of my short stories take place in where I grew up, which is East Texas. So I grew up in Houston, and I went to school in Huntsville and like Beaumont area, so closer to Louisiana. And, you know, it's a very important sense of place for me. And I kind of took that, but then I set it entirely in Dallas, which is right, not where I'm from. So, but I like think Dallas has such an interesting, you know, past. There's like the JFK assassination happened there. Then there's also like, everyone thinks of the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders, or they think of Dallas, the show. Mm-hmm. And it's all these very different things that are juxtaposed together to kind of create this sense of place or understanding of what is Dallas. Is it the Stockyards? Is it JFK? Is it the Cowboys? You know, what is it? And I thought that it was just a really interesting setting for what I was also trying to do.
Yeah. And you need somewhere that can have a house that would have changed hands enough times to have had a few different stories in it. And I think Dallas does give you the not transience, but the movement to allow for that.
For sure. Dallas is a very different place than it was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's kind of what I was trying to, I mean, it's very different and also very the same, I would say. But I think that, you know, I was trying to kind of build on that concept of the building blocks, like I said before, of like what gets left behind and what gets brought forward. And so I just thought Dallas was a really great place to set that. Plus, I love their ranch style homes. I mean, like, who doesn't love Sunset Magazine and like the 1970s ranch houses? Like, I'm obsessed with them. So it was really cool to kind of get to go back through some of my old Sunsets and reimagine that.
That's so funny. So Chicago doesn't, I just today, literally today, I did a search on Zillow for ranch. I'm like, are there any ranch houses for sale in the city limits, because it's just like not a style of home that was built in Chicago. We've got bungalows, two flats, six flats. There's just not a lot of one story single family homes, and certainly not, I guess, ranch. We had them a lot in Indiana.
Yeah.
Because I think the lots are wider, and I think of a ranch house as being a pretty wide house sometimes. But still kind of skinny.
Yeah, and like flat, you know. Mm-hmm. They're like, they just have that one story, and I just think they're so interesting. So I don't know why I'm drawn to them. Probably because I grew up in an area that like didn't have quite the sprawling ones that I've seen in Dallas, but you know, Houston in the 50s still had a lot of those like really, you know, classic 50s and 60s architectural homes that my great grandma owned one, and it was just one of those like flat kind of modular 1960s style houses, and I just was obsessed with it when I was a kid. I wanted to live in that house, and exactly what happened to her house kind of happens in the story. It got taken over by a development company after her passing, and so I kind of wanted to give the house in the story a happier ending, I guess. So yeah,
I love that, because you have the third woman who comes to the house is an aspiring influencer who wants to become a house flipper.
Yes.
I love that.
Yeah.
That's such a modern story.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think that there's a lot of people. I mean, I know people even who their goal is to basically flip houses, you know, for a living. And I think it's a very popular job in Texas, particularly. There's a lot of houses. I think, what is that? The Magnolia people that have that place in Waco. What are they?
Right. The Shiplap couple.
Yes, Joanne, the Shiplap couple.
Gaines. Chip? Will Chip. And Joanne? No.
I thought his name was Chip. Chip. Yes. Okay. I was like, it's something like more shiplappy than Will. But so yeah, they, you know, took over Waco basically to like start an empire of house flippers. And so I kind of wanted to play on that a little bit because, you know, they are Waco now, which is, I mean, I guess better than the Branch Davidians. So it is what it is. But, you know, I have people that I'm friends with in California that have flown down to Texas, to Waco, of all places, to like visit the Magnolia Mecca. And I just didn't know that it was such a big deal. But now that I do, I was like, well, I'm going to work this into my story. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where that came from.
Yeah. And so the book came out at the very end of February. Mm-hmm. And then you were off to AWP. Yes. Did you get to have a book launch? Do you have any in-person events or virtual events planned to celebrate the launch?
Yeah, so I actually had a really nice book launch in San Francisco. I live in Berkeley, but a lot of my writing community is in the city. So yeah, we did like a group reading, and The Racket, who's an online publication as well as a reading series, kind of threw a little party for me. So it was really nice. And then I got to read in Seattle at Outer Planet Brewing for AWP with the Whiskey Tit family. So I got to read with them as well. So I've gotten to do two in-person events so far, and I'm set to do one more for the Bay Area Book Festival in May, and then maybe a couple more readings here and there. So it's been really exciting because I've gotten to do a lot of in-person stuff.
Did you get to do, I assume, book number one, nothing in person?
I did do, I think we went to AWP that year. So we went to Philly the year.
Oh, right. It was only, you said it was a year. They were a year apart. So yeah, we were vaccinated by then.
I think I had all three, actually, of the first one, the first round. So yeah, I think, but yeah, we went to Philly for the first one. And then I did do some virtual events for that one as well, just to be, you know, safe. And the second book I didn't do like a huge event for, but we did have a little party with some readings and music and stuff. So I've gotten to celebrate pretty much all year. It's been pretty great. It's been like my birthday, like all year. So it's been amazing.
It's book year instead of a birthday month.
It's so much better than a birthday month. I'm just like, yes, this is exactly what I had dreamed of as, you know, a little girl, book month. Yes.
I interviewed Cameron McKenzie a few weeks ago. And he specifically talked about the AWP in Philly and going to a reading at a bar called Fergie's.
Ooh.
Like having been at one reading and then everybody from that reading was like, well, who's going where next? And all the after hours things that happen. And he was like, well, I'm going to Fergie's, this bar I know. And they all went. And then there was like an open mic. And I think one of the nice things about interviewing so many authors is that I, you know, I follow everyone on Twitter and I still use Twitter. And learning about AWP through people's tweets and Instagram posts, and because it's not something that's ever been on my radar to attend.
Yeah,
because I'm a marketer. I work in financial services, but now I know all these authors, and I'm like, oh, maybe I'll just go next time as a rando.
You should. It's it's like you get to hang out with everyone you know from the internet, so mm-hmm. you just go and you're like, oh, I'm gonna go to this person's reading that I've never met before, but then they like sign your book and like now you're real friends and it's great, you know? So this year was really fun. I got to, you know, go to a bunch of readings, but I also got to meet some of the people that like I know off Twitter and like I know from like my Discord writing group and hadn't met in person before. So, and one of them lives in Canada. So it's like, you know, we all converged and I got to meet these people that have been a really big part of my writing journey, but I just, you know, get to say thank you in person. It means a lot. So
outstanding. Well, congratulations. Foundations is available. I will link to it in the show notes. We'll link to the bookshop.org and the whiskey tit links as well. They can get The Drowned Woman on bookshop.org. And then one of the other Abigail Stewarts has a book on psychology and history.
Yes, I know. She's my competition.
Yes.
She's out there publishing these really intense academic texts.
Yeah.
So she's not really my competition, but she is the other Abigail Stewart that's like in the publishing world. So.
Yeah. There was this, you know, I started blogging in 2003. Oh my God, 20 years ago. And at the time, there were only two Leah Joneses on the internet, me and a woman who was one of the first female pilots of a certain type of plane during World War II.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, I feel so bad that my blog about like living in London is pushing this groundbreaking woman pilot off of the first page of Google. And eventually her flying club, she flew Piper Cubs, and every year she went to this reunion, and eventually they collected her stories into a little bound, we're talking like went to Kinko's, printed them out, and bound them at Kinko's.
Got it.
Her stories of taxiing planes, Piper Cubs across the country in the 1940s, and I have this like dream of, and she has since passed away. But they capture these really interesting moments. And I'm like, ooh, I don't know anything about optioning rights for movies, but I want so badly for someone to option the rights to her story, because they're just these little vignettes of unvarnished what it was like to be at first a high school girl learning to be a pilot and then a young woman and a mechanic working on Piper Cubs during World War II is fascinating.
That sounds fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I also was blogging in the like early aughts. So I think I started blogging in maybe around that time. Mm-hmm. So maybe a little earlier, but I definitely, you know, discovered that I think at the time I was the only searchable Abigail Stewart also on the internet. So it was definitely a time to be alive.
Yeah.
But no, that sounds so interesting. You should definitely look into a screenplay.
Yeah. I'll have to read through it again and see if I get a good idea.
Yeah.
I love when people say to me, I don't really have hobbies, and then send me a list of 25 things that they could talk about. But you had on your list books that are journals, particularly if they are artist journals. And I'm so curious about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to talk about artist journals. So, yeah, I think that I became a fan of like diaristic writing probably, I don't know, maybe a decade ago, when I first relocated to San Francisco and read The Folded Clock by Heidi Julewicz.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so good. And it was this story that was an interior story about being a woman and being a creative and all of these things. And then probably my favorite artist's journal is Daybook by Anne Truitt, who's mm-hmm. one of my favorite artists, but I didn't know she wrote. And then I found her book and I just devoured it. I could not stop reading it. It was so fascinating to me. And basically it's called Daybook, The Journal of an Artist. Like literally that's the subtitle. And it's basically just covering these couple years of her life, starting kind of, I believe, in the 70s, like the late 70s or mid 70s, like 74. Mm-hmm. And it goes until like 76. And so it's just her daily journal. But if you look at her art, she's a minimalist sculptor, and she has these larger than life, like columns that she's created that are all, you know, color, kind of her own grammatical understanding of color. So she's explaining the world through her sense of color, I think. And particularly she did this series of, I believe you pronounce it Arundel, series of white paintings that were like wildly unpopular. Mm-hmm. And so she writes about that in this book of putting out this art that's just wildly unpopular. And I don't think I'd ever read anything like that before, where a creative woman is saying, like, I have fear, you know, like I put this out and I'm not sure if anyone understands it or likes it. And the book is like peppered with stories of also like domesticity. So being at home, caring for her three kids who she has full custody of. And she's kind of dealing with that aspect, but then also trying to go out to her studio every day and create these minimalist artworks. So she's driving these columns, you know, building them, painting them, and exhibiting them throughout these years in the book. And it talks about her exhibits, and it talks about the lead up to them, and then the critical kind of fallout after some of them and how she feels about it. But, you know, she was a minimalist artist at a time when I think there were not very many women mm-hmm. minimalist artists. It was a very male-dominated movement. Like you think immediately of like Rothko or someone like that, but not Anne Truitt. And so she was, you know, kind of a pioneer. And then there's this one moment in the journal where she's asking her son, Sam, to like help her move one of the columns because they're gigantic. And he's helping her, and she asks him, you know, kind of like, what do you think? And he's like, Mom, I've never understood your art. And it was just like this moment where you're like, oh my gosh, like not only can you create a child that is like unknowable to you, basically, like mm-hmm. she doesn't understand how he sees the world, but you're also creating art that might be unknowable to other people. And she kind of like laughs about it and is like, oh, well, you know, she's like, I never considered that he like didn't get what I was doing.
Right.
And it was just this like really intense moment of like female creator, you know, mom, child interaction and all of these things rolled together. And I was just really moved by it. Yeah. So she is just somebody that I really admire, and her writing is very good also. And then I think the other thing that really struck me in the book is it's one of the only times that I've ever read about a female creator talking about money, like what is capitalism to art, I guess. Is money, you know, a tangential benefit? is creating as a job the ultimate goal? You know, does capitalism affect the output of art? If you're trying to make money, do you compromise what your vision is? So she like tackles the issue of finding the freedom to create, but also like the monetary shackles that bind artists. So I think I found that really interesting because I hadn't read another female creator basically saying, and she says it in the book, like, I will never be able to support myself with my art.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sad, you know, but it's also real. So I just admire that a lot.
Yeah. So were you, you said it was about, it was 10 years ago, it was when you moved to the Bay Area.
Yes.
Did you come across the first one of these artist journals just browsing a bookstore, or how did you, do you remember picking up the first one and realizing, oh, I need more of these?
Yes. So I found Daybook actually at a used bookstore in Berkeley, randomly. And I just saw it said as a subtitle, like the Journal of an Artist. And I was like, oh my gosh, I think I've seen her works before. I have one of her art books, and I didn't like connect the two, I guess. So when I found Daybook, of course, I immediately bought it and, you know, read it voraciously. Mm-hmm. And then I went on and started kind of looking for other memoirs of artists, but also memoirs of, or I guess diaries of women. So mm-hmm. Another one that I read recently was Celia Paul's Self-Portrait, which is not as specifically a journal, like with dates and everything. It's more memoir writing, but also deals with her, you know, life as an artist. And she's also written the introduction to some of Anne Truitt's books. So there's a lot of like synchronicity there, I feel like. But I haven't read her newest book, but I really enjoyed Self-Portrait. And it just kind of goes into her life as an artist again and like becoming a mother and dating this painter that was much older than her and having a son with him and then, you know, kind of where her life goes from there. But it's super interesting. It's just like there's all of these, I guess you could call it like normal worries in these books about mm-hmm. like being a woman, having sex, having a child, who you're dating, you know, your partner, things that all of us think about sometimes in some way. And I think that it's interesting to read, you know, I guess like the thing about domestic chores, like, oh, I need to do the dishes. I need to pick the lemons off the tree in the backyard. I need to wash the paintbrushes. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, they're creating these like amazing, like genre defying, you know, pieces of artwork that have just, you know, in my opinion, they're both wonderful artists. And it's interesting to just read their inner thoughts. Like, I'm like, what do you think about? And they do think about art a lot. Like, there's a lot of things that are like, how do I express, you know, my feelings? I think Anne Truitt says several times, how do I set color free? Mm-hmm. And that's like her thesis basically, is that she's wondering how to do this. Meanwhile, like her kid's getting married and like, you know, having a kid right. and like she's becoming a grandma and like all these things are happening to her that are kind of like just normal things. So I don't know. It's like artists, they're just like us, I guess. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So I find that really interesting. And then another one that I had read that's not an artist's book, but is a writer's kind of diary is Lauren Elkin's number 9192.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just completely fascinated by the concept because she basically takes notes that she's written in her notes app over a year of commuting on the number 91 and 92 buses in Paris.
Oh.
And it's just like observations, just like today I observed this, you know, kind of thing. And they're completely taken as they are, you know, not a lot of editing. And she collected them into this great collection. And I was just like, wow, this is so raw and so interesting. And so, you know, you feel like you can touch their brain almost, you know, like mm-hmm. I know what you were thinking on this day. And I find that really fascinating. So.
Yeah. And it's, I think something interesting to me is at what point do people decide they're writing for publication?
Ooh.
Because I was looking at Anne Truitt's, the first two of her journals, the audiobooks she recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one she didn't. But I wonder, you know, halfway through the year, did the writer you just mentioned who was just taking notes, who decided to publish her notes, like at what point did that cross her mind and you start taking notes for public consumption? Or is it many years down the line that they pull it on? They're like, okay, maybe there's something here to share.
Yeah, I don't know. It's her stories, specifically Lauren Elkins, number 91 and 92, were kind of post the Charlie Hebdo attacks. Mm. So I think that she felt there was something to say there, maybe. I'm not sure if she was planning to publish them prior to the attacks, but I don't want to speak for her. I just think that, you know, maybe there's something that happens sometimes and then public transit becomes a much more complicated thing. And you're like, well, you know, this is my experience of being on public transit and the time leading up to this. And now that this, you know, thing has happened and changed perception, maybe I do have something to say about this after all. As far as Anne Truitt, I'm not sure. I mean, she is such a fascinating person to me. She may have always been writing for publication. I'm not sure. Yeah. So again, I don't want to, you know, speak for her, but I think that a lot of the things she says, like, I find super interesting that she started these journals pretty late. You know what I mean? They weren't written at the earliest part of her life or her, you know, she's not writing like Celia Paul writes backwards, but she writes kind of her school days stories of, you know, being in the art institute and things like that. Whereas Anne Truitt kind of starts and you're like, she's already like putting stuff in galleries, like she's already there. So even in day book, she's not working backwards. So I'm not sure because she was probably like, I want to say maybe in her 60s when she, you know, had this published because it was in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know. But it was published in 81 and she started writing it in 74. So I'm not sure at what point. Maybe she didn't decide. I don't know. It's a lot to think about.
Yeah, it's one of the things when you talk about Anne Frank, right? Mm-hmm. The most famous diary any of us have ever read.
Right.
Is that there was a point where she heard on the radio that they were looking for diaries and she started editing for publication. Anne Frank did.
Yeah.
And you know, when I think about blogging, we were talking about blogging in the early aughts and how much of that was just like, I mean, there was a book at the time called Naked Blogging.
Mm-hmm.
Just how much of it was public, a public daily diary published. And then I also had like written like journals for the more private thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
But I read the things I was willing to say online in my 20s and I'm like, ooh, delete it all.
I mean, I definitely, you know, cleared the cache a while ago, but yeah, I mean, I definitely did the same thing. I think I put way too much out there when I was a teenager, but you felt kind of safer, I guess, on LiveJournal, a little bit more protected. I think for me, when blogging shifted to publication was, I can't remember her name, Jenny, the bloggess.
Yes.
I think when she got her first book deal, I think all of us kind of realized like, oh, like we're basically putting our best work online for everyone to kind of freely consume.
Right.
And that's when I think things kind of maybe took a turn towards what if I published this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I remember the blog her because I used to work in social media at large agencies. So I helped build the earliest days of this terrible influencer economy we now have. I feel a lot of guilt for it. Oh, I don't do that type of work anymore.
Oh, Jenny Lawson. That was her name.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. I was like, it just came to me. Yes, she was, and she was in Houston. So I was like all in on her blog mm-hmm. and like initially. So.
Yeah. All those bloggers, the mommy bloggers at the time. And then there was the whole other world of like Tumblr, one joke Tumblrs that became books also. Yes. And the publishers that were sourcing straight from just Tumblr blogs.
Yes. They were all at Urban Outfitters, all the mm-hmm. books.
Would you ever allow your private handwritten journals, or if you type your would you ever publish your private journals?
Oh, that's such a hard question. So I would maybe consider it, but my private journal is very private. And mm-hmm. even my fiance like protects that privacy. Like he, you know, if he sees it out, he doesn't even like make eye contact with it. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? So I don't know. At the beginning of the pandemic, I took a box of journals from my early to mid 20s, I guess, and threw them away. Mm-hmm. So it felt super freeing.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I don't even want these in my house. They feel like cursed objects. I'm just going to get rid of them. And so I threw them away. But the journals I have now are probably from 29. Mm-hmm. to now. So yeah, it's I feel more confident letting people read maybe what I've written now than in my, you know, teens and 20s. So sure. But yeah, I also don't know if I'll keep these. I might get into my 40s and I'm like, actually I'm gonna throw all my 30-year-old journals away too. And when I write in my journal, I just like I don't think about it again. It's more like I'm getting something out and I'm putting it in a box and I'm leaving it there. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not intending it for publication. So yeah, I don't know. I'd have to think about it, but I might consider it.
Did we talk about, I don't think we have yet, Diary of a Provincial Lady?
Oh my gosh. I love that book so much. I have so many things to say about Diary of a Provincial Lady. So,
is it, I mean, it sounds very 1800s to me, but maybe it's not.
It's not. So Diary of a Provincial Lady is, I think the title is very tongue-in-cheek. And it was originally serialized in a 1930s newspaper in the UK, in Britain. Mm. And it's by E.M. Delafield, and it's a collection of four books, at least the edition I have is. I think it was originally published as four books, kind of to reflect the serialized nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I picked it up actually in a Notting Hill bookshop when I was in England last year. And I just picked it up randomly because I was like, this sounds exactly like something I would read. You know, mm-hmm. like Diary, Provincial Lady, like, yes, give this to me. I love like novels of the British countryside. Like, is it a romp across the British countryside? I will read it. So I read a lot of like, I would say 1920s to 1960s, like female British writers specifically. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was fascinated by this. I'd never heard of it before. I picked it up and it's basically the portrait of a woman who's busy with domesticity and social obligations and just takes it upon herself to write it all down. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the only thing she really does for herself. And I thought that that was really interesting. So she was just kind of like, her husband's like, why don't you just go to bed? And she's like, because I'm writing in my diary, you know? Mm. So it's this time that she sets aside in the day of all of these different things and kind of to take time for herself. And I just thought that was really great. But the title I think of as like being pretty tongue in cheek because I don't think of her as being provincial. So in the 1930s, I feel like she's quite modern and feminist for her time. Like, she's actually, you know, she lives in a, I guess what you would call maybe a provincial area, but her social commentary is very witty, very keen observation. And it's just like all of her neighbors that come over are, she describes them, it's hilarious. Or I think it's hilarious. So there's like the vicar and the vicar's wife. And then Lady B that she has like disagreements about like planting tulip bulbs and different things. So mm-hmm. it's just all the drama. But the book brings us like basically to the brink of World War II. Realistically, she dies in the 40s. And so you kind of know, like, she's seeing it very hopefully, like, oh, we have gas masks, we have protection, we have things like that. And, you know, that's kind of not what happens in reality, but her writing, you know, is still kind of hopeful, like maybe this won't happen. And so, you know, you end with it feeling like maybe these women that are being asked to kind of volunteer, you know, they're like, why are we doing this if not for hope? And I think that she's like really focused on making herself a useful part of the war effort. And reading that was just, you know, it was fascinating because it goes completely in a different direction than her living in the country house, right? And I just found that really interesting. But it was just, I found it really pleasurable to pick up and read a few entries at a time. I read it really slowly. Her voice is just really witty. It just felt like you were like having a little coffee chat with your best friend, you know? And so I, despite the serious nature of it, really enjoyed the book, and I thought it was really intelligent. And, you know, I wish she had been able to write more.
Yeah, she's, it's got a 3.91 on Goodreads.
Does it? I didn't know. I mean, that's good. Yeah, go her.
Yeah. So,
I think that I'm not sure what the original book was called, the first kind of slender collection of it, but the four book collection that I have is pretty long, and it's just so good. Like, I honestly am just trying to wait until I forget enough about it that I can reread it. So
wonderful.
But yeah.
Yeah, so it seems like she takes what she knows from her own life, but then anonymizes it and creates the journal, creates the diary of a fictional woman.
Yes. And she, like, I think most of it is pretty autobiographical. I'm not sure if she changed anything since she was publishing it, you know, anonymously. But in the book, she alludes to people knowing who she is. So, like, there's someone that comes over to tea and is like, you better stop talking about all your friends or you're not going to have any left, kind of thing.
Okay.
So I think it's, like, alluded to that she may, you know, some people in her circle may know it's her. And she ends up winning, like, a couple of little writing contests here and there. And, you know, at the time, the 1930s in England was not a super popular time for women writers. So, sure. Yeah, she's just a pioneer. She's another pioneer that's like putting her journal out there. And I mean, she obviously always went into it with the intent to publish because she was writing for a magazine, but or newspaper. I can't remember if it was a newspaper or a magazine, but I know it was serialized initially. So, yeah, I find that really interesting. It's also interesting that we don't really serialize things anymore like that, but
right.
I miss it.
Yeah, you'll see, you know, New Yorker or certain magazines will have short stories, but not serialized stories.
Yeah, I think the best place to find serialized stories right now is probably Substack, honestly. Like, I think people post there a little bit more, but yeah, I miss it kind of being a more mainstream thing, you know. If it's good enough for Dickens, it should be good enough for us.
Yeah.
But I think I was thinking about how she was anonymous, E.M. Delafield, and I don't know if you had seen a recent book that came out. Alba de Cespedes did a book that was translated by Anne Goldstein with – she recently put this out. So it was published in the 50s, and it was kind of dealing with some of the same things, but it's like post-World War II, and the woman in the book, Valeria, is kind of – she's writing in a forbidden notebook. So the book is actually called Forbidden Notebook. Sorry, I should have said that. It's called Forbidden Notebook, and she buys the notebook, and she's not supposed to have it because they're not supposed to have paper. And she hides it and basically keeps the journal of an entire year And again, it's just very, it's a, the writer is very feminist. She's fascinating, actually. Although she was, I believe, her parents were Cuban, or her dad was Cuban. And she ends up getting involved in all of these like really fascinating political movements. And so I think she was arrested at one point. And so she wrote this book, and it is fictionalized journal, but it's still, I think, really an exemplar of like women and how they were living at that time, sort of in fear, and sometimes in fear of like their own feelings, in fear of like their family, in fear of their husbands, maybe in fear of, you know, another war. So it's another really good example of a journal, but it is purely fiction, and with a feminist take, because the author has intent, I think, to share that. But it is another really fascinating one that I just read.
And what was that one called again?
The Forbidden Notebook. Or actually,
the Forbidden Notebook.
Forbidden Notebook. Yeah, it's really good. So, and Anne Goldstein also translates all of Elena Ferrante. So it's I like trust her translation, I guess. So
yeah, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I really enjoyed all of Elena Ferrante's books, and I think that she's a you know, really talented writer. But I think Goldstein's done a good job of translating her as well. Mm. And like, it's great because we get to read stuff that, you know, isn't, it's not accessible to me because I'm monolingual, but I appreciate the work of translators so much.
So it's interesting. I thought initially when you talked about journals, it would be, or artist journals. I have some that are like copies of their sketchbooks.
Yeah.
Or people's travel journals that are, things are taped in them and it's handwritten and it's the reproduction of a sketchbook or of a sketch diary. I don't know why just like a plain text diary didn't even cross my mind.
I think when you say, you know, artist journal, you're thinking of like maybe the inspirational notebook they keep, like with paint samples and colors and things like that. And I don't know. I mean, I think of that as more like an inspirational, like, mood board situation, I guess. But maybe it's not for other people. I'm not sure. But yeah, I think that, you know, having people that are writing side by side their art, I find that really interesting because you're doing two disciplines at one time and kind of expressing yourself in painting or in sculpture or whatever, and then also in word. And I find the, you know, the combination really interesting. So yeah.
Are there artists that you, that have not published journals that you wish would publish?
Oh, that's such a hard question. let me think for a second. Not off the top of my head. There's not one that I'm like, oh man, like I haven't heard from them. I would really have to think about that. Anne Truitt was an exciting discovery for me. So I've kind of branched out from there, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to think about it.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's not an easy or fair question.
Yeah, I was like, let me, like, I don't know. I have so many books, but not off the top of my head. I can't think of anyone, but yeah, I'm sure that if they publish it, I would read it. So,
right. I guess the other thing is like, you might, I'm certain that like Georgia O'Keeffe has published, that they have published her diaries or journals or writings. And by saying I wish they would publish it, like, am I just showing that I'm ignorant that like, oh my God, Leah, there are five books. So that's also scary to me.
I think Georgia O'Keeffe has published a collection of like, I think it's literally called, is it called Notebook or something? I think that she did publish one, but I have not read it. So I cannot speak to it, but I think it's out there.
Yeah. So we have a little bit of time left. Do you mind if I ask you about cheese?
I would love to talk to you about cheese. I love cheese, and I would love to have a conversation about cheese. Let's talk cheese.
All right. And you said specifically queso.
Oh, yes, I did. I believe that I said that because that is something that I would say. So I am from Houston, and I love queso. That's basically like if I was still on like dating apps or anything, that'd probably be mm-hmm. my profile because I just love queso so much. But like people come to me for like my queso input, you know, that's how much I enjoy it. They're like, I found the white Velveeta, and I'm like, that is the correct Velveeta. You have to have the white Velveeta, you know.
So nice.
I have, you know, deep opinions, but I actually just went at AWP. I went to a Southwestern restaurant. I think it was called Hatch, and they had pretty amazing queso fundido. So you never know where you're going to find it, you know. Yeah. And if the place has a really good queso, like, I will be back to eat it. I think the most interesting queso I've ever had is actually at a place in Russian River or on the Russian River in Guerneville. And they do a goat cheese queso. And I was like, I'm sold. I will come back and have this many more times. So I don't think
of goat cheese as being a melty cheese.
I think it had to have been mixed with something else. Like, I don't think it was purely goat cheese.
With a cream?
Yeah. Like, I don't think it would have worked with just goat cheese. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask for specifics, and I should have, but I was just, like, so delighted that I didn't question it. I was just like, this is happening. But, yeah, I just think that there's more to queso than the Velveeta-Rotel combo that people do normally. And, you know, it can really be an elevated food. So,
I think it's true. I encountered – so I'm from Indiana, but I lived in Durango, Colorado for 3 years.
Awesome. Love Durango.
And that is where I first encountered Hatch green chilies.
Yes.
and possibly is where I learned that people put Rotel in melted Velveeta. I don't know if I knew about that, even putting Rotel in it before I moved to Colorado. So let's be honest, let's be fair. But Hatch green chili season, when even like at Walmart, there's someone out front charring green chilies, and you can just buy a paper bag of fresh charred green chilies.
Yes.
Ugh.
Yes.
And then you add that to your queso, and it's just, that is elevated.
I agree. Spent a lot of time in like New Mexico and Colorado growing up, and definitely Hatch chili season is like one of the most exciting times of year. So mm-hmm. I'm like, just make sure you get as many as you can hold. And then, you know, I would freeze some and keep them so that I could use them throughout the year.
If you're hosting a party, talk to me about what goes into your ultimate queso. Like, if you're doing little crock pot action, or do you even do it in a crock pot? Do you think it should go in the oven and come out in cast iron? Talk to me about how you serve queso if you're in charge.
I definitely use a crock pot. Okay. I am a crock pot. I was raised by a crock pot lady, and mm-hmm. I have become a crock pot lady, and I accept that about myself. So I like to do the vegetables like separately. So I char them first, but I usually do peppers, either Hatch or jalapeno, whatever I can find, poblano sometimes, definitely tomatillos, and then onions. And so get those all grilled up. And then I make the meat, and you should get like the really fatty beef. I'm not advocating for it to be all the time, but when you're mm-hmm. making queso, you need some of the fat to like get into the cheese.
Yeah.
And then
ground beef or sliced beef?
Ground beef for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Ground beef. And like just don't get like the lean, healthy kind. Like just get the regular kind that you would use for like really like greasy burgers, you know?
Yeah.
And I put that in with the vegetables separately, but make sure you put all the grease in.
Okay.
And then definitely, depending on how much you're making, I think you can use a full large block of Velveeta. And then I add usually a little bit of like whatever festive cheese I have in the fridge. I always have cheese in the fridge. So if it's like a Mexican blend or some extra cheddar or something to make sure that it doesn't just taste like Velveeta.
Sure.
And then, yeah, you just let it do its thing. I think that that's my ultimate queso.
Wow. I mean, that is, it truly never occurred to me to cook the vegetables first.
I mean, it just adds a little extra, you know? They taste better. And then they're just in there marinating with all of their, like, crispy goodness. So you can also, like, take the, or you're not going to take the queso out, but you can finish the queso faster because everything's cooked. You're not, like, actually waiting for anything to cook in it. But I also think that subbing the beef for chorizo is a good option.
So. Yeah.
Or soy rizo, if anyone out there is vegetarian.
Nice. So a few years ago for Christmas, my sister got me the crock pot, the trio of three little like quart sized crock pots.
I am so jealous. I want that so badly.
And so what I will do is I'll make like pulled chicken in an Instant Pot. And then I'll have pulled chicken in one of the three so that people can add meat to their dip, but then the dips are meat free. So I'll have pulled chicken in one, and then I will have a like yellow Velveeta, Rotel, maybe some Hatch green chilies with some added like half and half or something, but adding like adding shredded cheese makes more sense than just adding half and half.
Yeah, I think it gives it a little something. So I think you can also add, like sometimes I do a thing of cream of chicken soup.
Yeah.
Or cream of mushroom soup, and I'll put that in there. Whatever you have on hand is like totally fine. But usually cream of chicken is like my preference, and that makes it like extra creamy without, you know, putting even more dairy into it, I guess. So that's my other secret, you know, weapon. Smart. Is the cream of chicken. But yeah, no, my friend hosted a Halloween party this year, and he had the triple crock pot action happening, and he had like several dips, and I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And I might need to buy it. So I'm a little jealous, but I think it's a good thing to add to my Christmas list.
It's a really good investment because you can do three hot cheesy dips. Like you could do a buffalo chicken dip, which is like cream cheese, hot sauce, buffalo sauce, shredded cheese, shredded chicken all mixed in together.
I love dips. They're so good. I also finally gave in and bought an air fryer. So now I'm living the air frying life, which I was not prior because people kind of talked me out of it. But I really love it. I air fry everything now. So, nice. I mean, not like everything, but I like air fried frozen artichoke hearts the other night, and they were just crispy, and I just like dipped them in an aioli, and it was amazing. So, you know, I'm basically making vehicles for dips is what I'm making in the air fryer.
Anything
that can go into a dip, I'm like, yes, please. So my fiance makes fun of me pretty regularly for just being a dip person. Like that's what I will have for dinner. If it's presented to me, I will just eat dip, to the point where like when we first started dating, I was living in San Francisco and I was going to Safeway for groceries, and I had bought so many dips that like I had bought pimento cheese dip. I had bought like a salmon dip. I had bought something else like a spinach dip. And I had them all in my bag, and I had bought nothing else, like just like dip and then like vegetables and crackers. And like, I was just going to eat dip. And the woman.
I don't see a problem with what you're talking about.
I also do not see a problem with it. He wasn't actually judging me at the time, but we got up to the counter to check out, and the woman was like, "Are you having a party?" And I was like, "No." And she's like, "Maybe you should." And I was like, "No, I'm going to eat all this myself."
Yeah.
So. That's how much I love dip. I just want to go on record.
Have you watched Only Murders in the Building?
I haven't, but I hear it's good.
It's very good. Martin Short's character is on an all dip diet.
I love that. Yes, that's my life. Like I am also on an all dip diet. Like that's perfect. That is the life I want to live.
Yeah. He's always trying to find ways to get more dip and dips from different types of restaurants and taking the dips home from a catered party. It is a running joke in the two series, in the two seasons they've done so far, is his all dip diet. It's hysterical. And also I relate to it.
Yes. Like, I actually have never, you know, like, I've never felt so seen. Mm-hmm. So, but I am definitely, like, when I go out, I'm like, get them to give me, like, extra salsa. Like, make sure you bring back extra dip, because right. I want, like, more than what they usually give. So even if I have to pay extra for it, I don't care. I just want more.
Yeah.
That's my life. But I would happily be on an all dip diet. That sounds perfect, actually. Goals.
Well, Abby, it's been so fun getting to know you. Thank you so much for coming on Finding Favorites.
Thank you for having me. This has been so fun.
Where can people find you online?
Well, I have a website, helloabigailstewart.com, that links to my Twitter and Instagram presence. But I am Abby_writes on Twitter and Abby_cake on Instagram. Someone already was Abby Writes. So
yeah. It's hard. It's gotten so much harder to get to chase your username across the internet.
I know. And at the time when I made it, I was blogging but not professionally writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I was like, oh, I'll do Abby Writes as Twitter. But I have been Abby Cake on Instagram since probably 2008. So we're rolling with it.
Yeah. And your new novel, Foundations, it's been available since February 28th. So people should order that and leave you a good review.
I would love a lovely review for sure. And it should be orderable at your local indie as well as bookshop.org.
Awesome. Well, Abby, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.